Hello, everyone, and welcome to the latest edition of the You Should Run podcast. I'm your host, Tony Heil, council member in Bridgeport, Pennsylvania, which is outside of Philadelphia. And today we're going a little bit further outside of Philadelphia to an area we've talked with before in the Lancaster area. And I'm going to be challenging some perspectives, but not challenging my guests too much. But I think a lot of people, when they think of Montana, for example, they think of a very conservative red state. And then when we hear from Barbara Bissett in the previous podcast, you learn that it's actually a pretty purple area and more politically diverse than people expect. And similarly, people like me who've been to Lancaster know that it is a really interesting, awesome, rich place with a lot of diverse people and backgrounds and perspectives. But when you come from outside of Pennsylvania, your perspective may be a lot different when you think of Lancaster. And you might not get it pronounced right. So I am going to be talking with a council member who I'm very excited to talk with today, Mr. Israel Smith Wade L. And Ismail, thank you for joining the podcast.
Hey, thank you so much, Tony. I really appreciate the opportunity, and I think you got it right. I think Lancaster, especially Lancaster City, which is a city of about 60,000 people, really defies expectations about what this area is like in some really compelling ways.
Yeah, you know, I encourage you, if you get a chance, to check out my podcast with James Cooper from Oklahoma City, because, you know, Oklahoma City's got a professional basketball team, but to me, I think Oklahoma, and I think, oh, I don't know, and then realize it. Oklahoma City is awesome, and I vacationed in Lancaster last year. It is a really awesome place, too, right?
Yeah, it is. It's great. I like to think we've got it all, everything from, you know, nightlife, some really compelling art. Apparently Lancaster County hosts the nation's hot air balloon team, which is a thing that I didn't know recently, but there's also some challenges and opportunities in city government here that are reflective of challenges that governments are facing everywhere. And so in a lot of ways, we're hoping to be a model and a testing ground for some of the more important work, really, that's going to happen in the near future and in this century. So here's hoping.
That's a really positive way to look at government. And again, going back to the talk I had with James Cooper, and I think you're going to share a lot of that same perspective. You know, I ran for office, and I've been involved in politics for a while, and always asking people's issues. But it sounds like you're looking at the future, not just about, like, how do we fix the problem from yesterday.
Right. You know, I think, Tony, when you take a look at it, it's really challenging to go beyond even fixing the problems, just to think of how to conceive of the problems in a way that allows you to take them on both right now and in the future. I was actually having a really wonderful conversation with a constituent just yesterday about how to address housing needs in sort of a five-year window, but then knowing what's going to happen at the end of that five-year window and how we plan for the 10, 20, and 30-year window. And I think one of the hardest parts is what I like to say, Tony, is that you can't just ask people to suffer while we wait for the revolution, if you will. We have to balance these short-term and long-term solutions at the same time. And so if anybody out there thinks that they're a person who's good at that kind of thinking or just really cares enough about the place that they're from to challenge themselves to do more of that kind of thinking, I would recommend that maybe they should run for office.
Awesome. That really segues nicely into the whole format of this podcast. First of all, I really want to talk with you by email or phone after this, because these are topics I care about in my local community that we're discussing. But two, you obviously came to look at these future goals because of your past, because of your work before you got on to council there. So tell me a little bit about yourself and what kind of made you a political person.
Yeah, so I was born and raised in Lancaster City, and I was raised in a very political family, and I like to think of us as having a lot of of balancing that progressiveness with that faith, and I really think actually that those support one another. I think a lot of people on my side of the political spectrum see, you know, a challenge or an inherent conflict between faith and their political views, and I really don't think that there has to be. But anyway, while I was, you know, growing up here, I had one experience of Lancaster, and I kind of felt like the boundaries of it weren't big enough for me. It wasn't, you know, a terribly motivating or compelling place to me. And then after college, I returned here and found myself in a position where every day I was experiencing something new to learn about this city I had grown up in and something new to love. And so that just really sort of flipped my script on this city that, in fact, I had been born in. So after I moved back to town, I worked a number of jobs. But in 2015, I began working as the lead researcher for then-Mayor Rick Gray's Commission to Combat Poverty. So I was both organizing and conducting research projects on food insecurity, on housing, on wages, and on what nonprofit structures, what government policies could be most effective to solve our issues. So one thing that maybe a lot of people don't know about Lancaster is that we wrestle with a pretty significant poverty rate. We are down to a 26.5 poverty rate, up from, I think it was about 3 years ago when we had a 29.2% poverty rate. So while we're experiencing all of these really great things, all of this really great advancement and progress in the city, about a third of our neighbors really aren't able to participate in that. They're locked out of that for reasons of wealth and income. And Tony, I experienced Lancaster as this really great, fascinating place where people of all races, backgrounds, languages are coming together to try to build something better and brighter. And so the chief motivation for me to get into politics really is the opportunity to make it so that really all of us, to steal the Jess King slogan, can participate in this really great and wonderful thing that I've experienced. And what's great about local government is I think it has the most honesty of any level of government that there is. You know, if you have an issue with your council person or your mayor, and I'm sure you've experienced this, Tony, you can, you know, you can find them in the grocery store. You can walk up to them, send them an email and say, you know, hey, buddy, I've got a beef with X thing or Y thing. And on the other end is that people really tell you how they're feeling about everything from their, you know, their housing situation to how they might feel about their children, the educational system, crime, any of that. It's very real, and it's really very empowering because you have a direct connection to decisions that make changes in people's lives.
And I really appreciate that. The thing is, there's so many boroughs and cities and towns across the country that anyone that's listening, you could have that direct connection and have the power that you do if you choose to run.
Yeah, that's absolutely the case. I mean, the people on Lancaster City Council, I think, really represent something that's great about local government, which is that anybody who cares enough, who's willing to take the time to run and to think through the issues and to talk to people, can do it. You know, it's not one where everybody in government is a business person or everybody in government comes from, you know, wealth. One of my colleagues owns a hair salon. Two of my colleagues work at the local hospital on, you know, Lancaster City Council. It's not just an access point for, you know, kind of those who already have money and status. And in this most recent election, this most recent primary, we had three candidates come up who, again, don't necessarily have those sort of like deep old money, old politics connections, but what they have is a real passion for this place. Tony, I don't know if he's going to do this. Would it be acceptable for me to go ahead and shout them out?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, so there's Xavier Garcia Molina, there's Amanda Baykay, and there's Jamie Arroyo, all of whom, before running, were doing community benefit work from mediation and conflict resolution to working with survivors of sexual assault. Amanda is the director of operations at the local science factory. Just a really great group of people. So I just want to encourage anyone listening to just know that whatever your background is, there's something in it that can bring something to your understanding of local government.
Well, that goes to, well, two things. I want to get make sure I stay on focus here, but you ran in 2017, right?
That's correct.
So what was the thing that led you to run? What was there, did people encourage you and say, you should, you are the right kind of person? Did you see, like, an opening? What was the thing that said, oh, I'm going to go through with this and do it?
Yeah, so I was receiving a lot of encouragement from the community, and in 2017, I had just finished up my term with the Mayor's Commission to Combat Poverty, and sort of seeing that moment where we really had a choice about what the next decade of development was going to look like for Lancaster City, whether it was going to include everybody or not, was probably the biggest motivating factor to getting engaged in that particular cycle. And of course, I had a lot of support from friends and family and community members.
So, and you're running for local office. What was the number one, were there any surprises to you? Because you were involved in politics already. Was there anything when you were running that was like, oh, well, this isn't what I expected, and this is a challenge I was not really anticipating? Or did you just know, this is, I know what I'm doing?
I absolutely did not know what I was doing. And probably the biggest sort of mistake that I made was just to get really wrapped up in the anxiety of it. I spent a lot of time thinking about, oh, okay, well, if I don't do this, I'll lose, and if I don't do this, I'll lose, and if I don't do this, I'll lose. It was a fairly crowded field. There were 11 people running for 4 seats at that time. And it's not that it's not important to get all your ducks in a row and make sure you really work the streets, canvas, knock doors, do events, but that really just sort of agonizing over each piece doesn't really serve any candidate if it's taking them to a place of not being able to focus on why they got into it in the first place. I wouldn't say there were any big operational surprises, other than, again, just the level of candidness with which people, you know, engage with you as a candidate for local office.
Now, I imagine and it was a little bit easier for you to do this, because people have to get out of their shell when they run for office.
Right.
But you had been embracing and talking about a lot of these issues of poverty and community. So, you know, it's different than someone who is brand new and is like, oh, this is going to take me a few weeks of door knocking to get into it. Like, those conversations, they were, you were a little bit more comfortable than other people might be.
I think that's probably true. And I'm sort of a classic extrovert. Tony, I think for people who are sort of worried about that, who are more introverted or don't have that experience, I think there's really two things. One is just to be willing to challenge yourself, and then the second is build a team of people that you trust to help you run the campaign. It's always going to be a team effort. I think the more that people have people that they can trust and can rely on, the sort of tell them, one, what they're doing well and what they're not doing so well at, and help to lighten the load, the more likely they are to be successful.
And for you, because it was you were going for 4 seats and there were a lot of candidates for it, for those seats, in Lancaster City, it's really the primary that matters more than the general. Is that fair to say?
That is correct. Democrats have about a 3-to-1 registration advantage in the city, and have for about the past 4 or so years. So now you're correct. It is really the primary that is the sort of the big election.
So just for the last 4, so you've been, your family's from there. Has the city changed a lot then politically?
I think so. When I was a child. Mayor Janice Stewart won, and Democrats swept, I believe it was a four-seat cycle, four seats on the city council, and that was a big deal. And then the mayor that came after her was a Republican, and then since then we've had two Democratic mayors in a row. The city has gotten significantly more diverse. The African-American and Latinx populations have increased. Now we're a city with about 60% people of color, but it's also become a younger city. The median age in Lancaster is really about 30, and I think with that increase in density and diversity, those politics change. And so now we're reevaluating both our approaches to everything: economic development, education, policing. And that's not to say that we're sort of we're rapidly abandoning everything that's come before, but we're having different conversations than we were. In some ways that are maybe better, in some ways that maybe aren't as, let's say, robust than when there were really two political parties vying for power, at least within the city. Does that make sense, Tony?
Oh, yeah, definitely. And it really brings to mind what I was thinking with your first talks about, your background and people's talking about poverty is that for young people, and I grew up in the 80s and 90s, you look at politics as an older person's thing. You look at the Senate, the median age is 212. I might be off. I don't remember. I'm not exactly sure. But, you kind of expect that. But if you want politics to represent your area, then, you need young people to step up, right? Like, if Lancaster, if the median age is in the 30s, it doesn't make sense for it to be governed by people who are all, nothing against people in their 70s, but, there's a disconnect there if it's different generations only.
No, and you're absolutely correct, Tony. And this council that we're going to have in January of 2020, right, once our new councilors come on, is going to be primarily made up of people under the age of 40. And of course, there's, as you say, there's a value to that experience, to having lived and worked in a community for longer, and that institutional memory. But there's, I think, a level of both, vigor and intensity, and an approach that isn't necessarily as clouded by a mindset of, okay, well, this is the way we've always done it, so we have to do it so we don't alienate this set of people. I think having younger, fresher minds that aren't as sort of, locked into what they see as the institutional boundaries provides a lot of advantages. And so, we're constantly pushing up against the wall. Okay, we've never done this in Lancaster. Why not? Can we change it? Let's do it. And we're going to do that again tomorrow. And that's, I think, one of the greatest things about having, young people involved. And I think, so to younger would-be candidates, I would say, get involved, your time is now. And then there's this really sticky idea, I think, especially in the Democratic Party, about waiting your turn. And I think we've reached an area in politics where there aren't turns. When you feel that you have what you need to get the job done, you stand up and you do the job. And let everybody else sort out the idea of who should run when. That's not really your problem, and I don't think it's a thing we can afford to be concerned about in this day and age.
Oh, I totally agree. I look forward to, I'm not 40 yet, though I will be sooner than later. I look forward to more people coming up after me. I would like to maybe do more things, but that's a positive. But one thing I've been thinking about in this conversation is you said that the poverty rate is around 26%. That means that people who don't fall into that poverty rate are still the majority, right?
That's correct.
And my reason for saying that is it could, a different person could just immerse themselves with the majority who aren't poor. And so you can't fix the problems or address the problems that you don't see.
I think that's absolutely the case, Tony. And really the question that we've been trying to answer in Lancaster is how to not just address those needs, but I know this sounds kind of squishy and semantic, but to really see people who don't necessarily have the experience that we have, or people who have been on the short end of the economic stick. A thing that I like to say is that, yes, we have this 26% to 29% poverty rate, and it's important that we understand that that didn't happen by accident. Whether on a local or national level, choices were made about the distribution of wealth, about benefit programs, about certain policies that put us where we are today. And that's not a question of assigning blame, but it is a question of saying we now have a responsibility to do something about it. We have a responsibility to immerse ourselves in the lives and concerns of these people who, by the by, are our neighbors. No matter where we are, they are our neighbors.
And I know it can be very comfortable to talk with the people who are comfortable. Like, you know, if we have, I don't know exactly what the poverty rate is in our borough, but, you know, we're talking about housing issues because we're growing so fast in terms of housing costs and making sure we're not pushing people away and making sure that it's a community for everybody. It's a bigger deal in Lancaster, of course, because you got a whole city. I have a population of 4,500. But, you know, when you knock on someone's door and their house is clean and not that people who are poor are dirty, but, you know, if you feel comfortable in someone's house, you know, that's easier. And I think you need to have candidates who feel comfortable talking with people who are uncomfortable in life.
I think that's extremely true. And we need to get right with the idea of talking with people who make us uncomfortable. And I think that there's a tendency when people yell at us or they come at us from a direction that we're not really anticipating or we're not comfortable with to sort of tune them out. But oftentimes people that are approaching us in uncomfortable, maybe impolite or aggressive ways are doing so because they have really, you know, pressing, demanding needs that really can't afford to be ignored any longer. And that's something that has actually taken me some time to learn, to sort of, as a candidate and as an elected official, to step past my feelings about how somebody is addressing me in that particular moment, to, like, what is the value and the validity of the concern that they're raising? Is that something that I need to address sort of regardless of how they're talking to me? And that's a tough one.
Awesome. But it's tough, but you are doing concrete things. These are obviously things you care about through your work before being on council and as a member of council. So what are the things that you are doing that you find rewarding or important that our listeners, if they're considering running for office, can listen and be like, hey, if I run, I could do something too?
Yeah, absolutely. So when I was a candidate, I would say one of the most rewarding things to do is just to talk to people off of the beaten path of sort of the standard super voter. Get out and knock some doors that aren't necessarily on your knock list, or who might be in communities where, you know, you're not canvassing particularly heavily, whether that's because of, you know, voter record or other concerns. Getting out and talking to people anyway, I think is probably number one. Two is just digging into your passion issue. I think people are going to come to you with concerns, and you're going to need to address them. But you came into this role, whoever you are, whatever you're running for, with a passion and certain talents for certain things in certain areas. So if that's engineering, if it's green space, if it's, you know, trees, if it's, you know, policing and public safety, whatever that is, really, really lean in And I think don't, you know, be afraid to be that that specific person that you are. So get familiar with those parts of the city code. Organize community events, forums, conversations about that issue. Talk to local experts on that issue. Those are some of the most rewarding things that I've been doing, Tony, and they've really sort of allowed me to advance my agenda as a council person.
And those are things that, like, you know, if you're watching politics, if you're watching CNN, you think that you're a congressman, but a congressman can't do that easily because they're dealing with what's going on with Iran, they're dealing with the camps, they're dealing with all of these major issues that are important, but they can't get to the granular on a personal level. Their staff can, but you, as a council member, whether you're in Lancaster or whether you're in Nevada, whether you're in California or New York, you have the ability to get down to that granular level and do something.
That's exactly right. And you can even come up with, I'll back up. There is nothing more rewarding in local government, I think, than when somebody comes to you with a problem and then you can go to your team or other people that have your back and think of a solution that works for all parties involved. Whether that's like a legal change to an ordinance, whether it's the naming of a building, seeing those moments when you can apply some hard work and your own intelligence and actually make a difference in somebody's life, that's not like, it's not a number, it's not a statistic, it's not a phone call, it's an email, it's a person standing right in front of you, I think that's what makes it all worth it.
Awesome. So I think it's worth it too, obviously. So it's been a rewarding process being on council then, more so than not. Why would you encourage more people to run for office?
Yeah, it absolutely has been a rewarding process. I would encourage people to run for office for two reasons. One, we need more diverse people in office. And I think when the word diversity is used, people assume it means race, but it's race, it's economics, it's background, it's language, it's gender. We need to engage all the sectors of our community, and that's most efficiently done when all the sectors are represented at the table. The second is that good campaigns, good competitive primaries make for better candidates, and they make for better politics. When people have the opportunity to engage, when they have the opportunity to organize their constituencies and debate the ideas are more refined after the political process. The communities are organized after the political process, and then next steps can be taken from there, whether a given candidate wins or loses the election. I think one of our big mistakes is we think of elections as just being about putting a particular candidate in a particular seat. And they are about that, but they're also an opportunity to create a more engaged community on every level. And that's what our politics needs more than any individual candidate.
Yeah, I've talked about the need for diversity in a lot of these podcasts, and I've learned a lot. I'm sure that you've learned a lot, too. Has there been, because you have, you knew a lot before you ran through your work with the mayor and writing and whatnot. Has there been anything that challenged your perspective that kind of changed or evolved where you were?
Yeah, I think probably is just engaging with people specifically around this one issue, which is a tough one for me, which is parking. And learning about how parking intersects with all the other areas of government and society in ways that I didn't anticipate, just to be specific, because I really very much came into it as sort of a big picture, big issue kind of person. So, you know, saying like, okay, we want to tackle poverty, we got to tackle housing, we got to tackle wages, we got to figure out how to get into all of these things. And we're just sort of dismissive about, you know, parking and how people feel about car travel, but learning that that really is reflective of how people get through their day and intersects with all their other concerns. It can be an economic issue. It can be an equity issue, an issue of use of space, or an issue of poverty. So learning that even in the things that I sort of wanted to throw over my shoulder and not worry about, that those are going to be important to your constituents too, and that they matter. I actually think that most urban and suburban areas in the United States have too much parking. But there's real, validity in the concerns that people raise about, say, being able to park in front of their house at the end of the day. That's, they're tired. Like, what are they going through in their day that makes that such a necessity? How do they conceive of their ownership of their community and the space around them? Are they elderly? Do they have a disability that makes that a more pressing need? And that was the thing that when I started this, I was like, I don't want to hear from anybody about parking. I don't care. And so that was kind of a wake-up call.
Yeah, I have to say, I can't tell you how much I love that answer. I am a... The parking is one of the top five things that come across our little desks as a small borough. And for people to realize that you can get involved in these little things, I don't mean to downgrade it, but that they can make a significant impact on progressive needs, I think hopefully that will encourage people to see that all of this matters. That's a very important thing. So I really want to thank you. Is there anything else you want to end on as a final encouragement to our listeners about why they should get involved today, and or anything else that they could do if they're still skittish about running, or the only people they could run against are people that they like?
Yeah, and in fact, you keyed up something perfect. I actually don't think that you have to be afraid of running, quote unquote, against somebody that you like or that you have a friendship with. But more importantly, I think that a lot of people I talk to that say, oh, I don't want to get involved in politics because, I don't like the way that people get divided up by party. I don't like the way that people, they sort of lose their passion for it, et cetera. And to me, that says you are the person that should be in these offices, because there are definitely some people who run for office that are way too comfortable with politics as usual. So if politics as usual grinds your gears, then maybe I want you to consider that you are exactly the person that needs to be in that office. I think that's where I'll end, Tony.
No, I totally agree. You can't... Politics is going to happen regardless. So you can't just say, I don't like it, so I'm going to step away. It's going to happen, so if you want it to be better, do something.
You're here.
Great. Well, thank you for doing something. Thank you for running for office, and hopefully everyone listening will run. Please listen, subscribe, and share to listen to Councilman Ismail's discussion here, and listen to our past podcasts, including with our mutual friend, Jess King. And she's better friends with you than with me, probably. Thank you so much for being on the podcast today.
Hey, and thank you for taking the time, Tony. I appreciate it.
Have a good day.